You're listening to James Valentine on ABC Radio.
And welcome to today's edition of Panel for the Ages. And not only have I named it, I've done a theme.
Panel of the Ages, the Panel of the Ages, the Panel of the Ages, the Panel of the Ages.
Uh-huh. Yes, it is the James Valentine Choir there singing Panel of the Ages theme. And what we do here is I invite three people from different generations to come and talk about sort of issues of the week or so. Guest number one is Margaret Throsby, broadcaster. I put you as...
The nearly dead.
Right, okay, she's from the nearly dead, early boomer. Lucy Kippist is the editor of Flying Solo. Where would you put yourself, Lucy?
Pre-middle age.
That sounds like 1300 to me.
That feels about right.
Pre-middle age.
You're pre-middle ages, I'm dark ages.
You're dark ages, yeah. Or nearly dead.
And you're medieval, James.
I'm totally medieval. Talia Olatia joins us, presenter of Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Talia, good afternoon.
Hello. I feel like I would be the not cool enough for TikTok age, but still engages in it age.
That's nice. Not cool enough for TikTok. But still engages. Yes, I've got you there. Well, you'll be pleased to know that Hannah's pet segment, Talia, is inspired by a comment she said this morning. She said, "I follow this snail on TikTok," and I just thought that is the most.
Oh, I've been following birds.
Have you been following birds?
No. Fledgling eagles.
Oh yeah.
In Melbourne.
Yeah.
Did you see them on a windowsill?
And then
finally they all left.
And in what medium do you follow them?
I don't know, but I'm just wondering, what do you have to do to qualify to watch TikTok? I watch TikTok.
Well, I think, what did you mean, Talia?
Well, I just mean that I feel that I'm too old for it. When I watch it,
God,
it still feels like
old,
it's...
What am I?
Well, I know. Well, that's the thing. It just feels like it's supposed to be for teenagers because, maybe that's just my For You feed. It just feels that there is a lot of young people who are dancing, who are saying words that I don't understand, but there are some things that I still do. If I talk to it about my, TikTok to my parents, they are looking at me like I am from a completely different world. So right. I know that I'm not on that level that, you know... I'm not there, but I'm still in this just weird stage where I can still talk TikTok, but yeah. It just doesn't feel as authentic as,
Lucy,
you know, when the cool young kids do it.
Lucy, where do you sit in the social media? Which do you think is your generation's social media?
Well, I would have said Facebook, but I think Instagram. We're emerging into Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've never watched TikTok ever.
Right.
You don't watch Sarah Cooper?
No. None.
Go home and watch Sarah Cooper.
Okay.
So Sarah Cooper's the one that does the impressions
of
Trump.
She does the lip sync of Trump. But
she does
much more now.
Yeah.
God, she's funny.
I saw her. Have you seen the one where Sarah Cooper and Helen Mirren do the entire bus?
Hilarious.
Do the grab them on the pussy
hilarious.
Bus
when
incident?
When I looked at it, I thought,
it's so good.
Is that Helen Mirren?
Yeah.
And it was Helen Mirren.
And it's Helen Mirren. But what you realise is that in the creation of the news grabs... It doesn't in any way illustrate how appalling that conversation was as when you hear the whole thing.
That's right.
Like, it was unbelievable. Yeah. It's not a bad segue, really, into one of our first topics that I thought we'd think about, the bonking ban.
Oh,
and
yes. That's a very nice segue.
I'm mindful of the fact, I can go with ScoMo a bit, that the bonking ban does reduce a serious issue to a kind of, you know, a tawdry little headline. But on the other hand, if I sort of said the interrelationship protocols for, the relationship protocols in the workplace, you'd go, oh, do you mean the bonking ban? So I'm just using that as a shorthand to get us there. Reactions, what were things like? What do you think things should be like? Is it something where do we look at our parliamentarians and say, oh, that's appalling how you could do that? But is there any difference as to what they did as to what anybody should do in any workplace? But then what do you do about the fact that we're all human beings and we're going to meet one another? Lucy, you're nodding vigorously. What are you thinking?
Well, I just think we've got to go with the human vote on this because where else do you meet people these days in real life? Work's a big place to meet people, not necessarily romantic relationships, but all kind of relationships. But I think it's a place where you naturally are going to meet people who are more in line with your own values and you're drawn to the same industries.
And then does it need to be managed? Does there need to be protocols, clear rules around this in a workplace?
Well, I think probably there does have to be some kind of rules because if you overstep that, it's pretty awkward for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah.
If that gets overstepped.
Yeah. Margaret, what do you think? I heard someone of the nearly dead saying the other day that when they first went to work, there was a typing pool and the boss said to them, "That's where your wife's sitting." That's where your future wife is sitting in the typing pool.
Having worked as long as I have in the ABC, which is a hotbed of relationships and marriages, I mean, and divorces, people have... Somebody said to me early on, never dip your pen in the company ink. Never dip your pen in the company ink if you don't mind. Anyway, the thing that I think is on a serious level, first of all, the bonk ban, I don't mind that because it's very descriptive. Mm. It's what you'd expect a prime minister who's been in marketing, although it wasn't ScoMo that coined it. But I think it serves its purpose. But the thing that I have a problem with, and I agree with you, Lucy, that where else do you meet people except in the workplace? And in fact, you spend more time with your colleagues than you do with your partner.
That's right. Mm.
But I do think that where there's I'm going to be serious now. Where there's a power imbalance, then I think caution has to be applied. And so you look at workplaces or situations where there is a power imbalance. I think in the typing pool, all the men and women, not in the typing pool, but in the general population of an organisation like this one, for instance, journos and journos or presenters and whatever, you've got a generally level playing field. But when you've got people who are like parliamentarians who are the ones that with the power, the people that work for them are in the lesser. And if they stand up and scream when the relationship's over, then they might lose their job. So I think that, honestly, I've thought a lot about this. I think that Parliament is a place that should have a bonk ban right across the board. But workplaces generally, no, unless it's unless there is a sense that you really, if you're going to go to bed with the boss, you've got to watch out. You've got to be careful.
And is it the boss that should be watching out?
The boss and the person, you know, and it's often, traditionally, it's been a male boss and a female underling.
Yeah.
And I just get very discomforted by that because if the female then, if it breaks up and the female starts complaining, then she's shown the door.
Where'd you go? Dalia, what are you thinking?
I was about to say, I completely agree with Margaret there because it is about the power imbalance. When, you know, two adults are engaging in a consensual relationship, then that is on them and that is good. But when there is a power imbalance, especially in the workplace, where issues like job insecurity can also play into that power imbalance, when there are limited options for complaints for, you know, if that relationship goes bad, and the, you know, the onus of, you know, the fallout often falls on the woman in the majority of cases, and where there is a power imbalance, what will happen is men will tend to fail upwards, where women will be kind of shown the door and kind of shunned because she was in that same consensual relationship. So I do think that there needs to be workplace practices and things in order to prevent that any fallout from those relationships, because when it is on the same level, I mean, I have worked in many different workplaces where, you know, a workplace office romance was always, you know, the fodder for gossip of what was going on, considering if it's on the same line. Like, I remember being 14 years old and working at Kmart and talking to my colleagues of, you know, which boy on the floor that they thought was hot, and that was completely fine. But if a 14-year-old is, like, engaging in a relationship, you know, with the manager, not to mention all the, you know, the statutory things
outside
are part
of the
that.
Age things, yeah, yeah, I get exactly. Let's say 16, 17-year-old,
Then it becomes that power imbalance because it's like, well, what are the repercussions if that doesn't work out? Yeah. And very often it is, you know, the younger woman who is shown the door.
I wonder whether the Me Too has changed any of this. Mm-hmm. What does anybody think?
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, I was going to ask you, do you feel as though you have a clear idea what the rules are at the ABC or that there are rules?
I don't think that I necessarily have clear rules that there is that, you know, this is the level of, you know, who you should be having a relationship. And, you know, it's not as if I've just gone, like, no offence to our MD. It's not as if I've gone, you know, as a junior, hey, what's going up there and if anything would be happening. But I'm pretty sure that if that kind of relationship did happen, even if it was consensual, a lot of people would be talking about it from multiple different levels. And I think when it starts, the conversation changes ranges from, you know, how was the date to are you doing things? Are you looking after yourself? Like, what protections are you taking? Like, are you writing things down? Are you looking after yourself? Because it's not just about the relationship that is presently happening. It's about future implications of that relationship. And I think that the Me Too movement is completely correct, because I think that especially for my generation, it has completely changed the way that we think about what things, what men say to us in the workplace and how appropriate that is. And when it does blur those lines of, you know, this is not right and, oh, wait, we have to watch out for that person kind of
Let's
situation.
Let's bring in Margaret's Me Too question there. This is Panel for the Ages with Margaret Throsby, with Lucy Kippist, who's the editor of Flying Solo, and Talia Oldatia, who's presenter of Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Lucy, you were going to jump in.
Yeah, I just really like that point there about the duty of care extending beyond that rule. So even if something did happen and the law was there, the rules were there, the idea that the responsibility is on the employer then to follow up with that person at every stage, because that is where, as we've observed in the Me Too movement, that's where the damage is. It doesn't just happen in the moment. Can happen months, even years after, you know, a tumultuous relationship.
And do you feel as though Me Too is shifting things? I mean, we saw Hugh Marks, the CEO of Channel 9, say, yes, okay, I've done this not once but twice, and so I'll be the one going. Does that indicate a shift?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's great.
Yeah. Talia, do you feel a shift?
I definitely do feel that change is happening, maybe not at the level that we would like to see it, that would, you know, see really safe and, you know, inclusive workplaces where there are very, you know, HR processes. Because I think that that's the problem sometimes in workplaces, is that you don't know who to go to, what you have to say, and sometimes the onus of responsibility is on you as the victim to kind of sometimes re-traumatise yourself to create change for, you know, something else. And the thing that always annoys me when it comes to the victim is a lot of people will say, if you don't speak up, this could happen to someone else and you'll feel really guilty. Yeah. And it's like the victim should never be the one who is feeling guilty. It should always be the perpetrator.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, when high profile men do come out and, you know, take responsibility for their actions and what they have done, it does actually create change and it does, you know, make that conversation easier. But it also puts workplaces on notice too. So yep. Instead of waiting to change, they're actually getting on the front foot and going, okay, this is what we need to do to address it in the future rather than being reactive.
Margaret, as someone who goes from typing pool to Google Docs, do you see the change? Do you think there's a change?
I was just thinking when I was listening to Talia, I think the ABC as an organisation, which it's very big, although it's shrunk a lot, but I think that there is a great awareness in the ABC. I think the ABC is doing good stuff. We have a very active mentoring program in which this sort of thing can be discussed and is, and avenues suggested that might be taken up. But I think that the ABC is very, as far as I know, is very aware of the Me Too movement, very aware of the imbalance of power in the organisation. And I mean, I'm not just saying it's brilliant and therefore it should, you know, rest on its laurels. I think every big workplace and small should be aware.
But you can feel the change. You can see the change.
Yeah, I think it's very different from when I was young. I mean, golly, gosh, it's different from when I was young. When I was little, I said, when I was young.
When you were little. When little Margaret was first started. Couple of comments on the text service are worth bringing in. I just did a quick head count of all my male friends, and if we did the power imbalance, none of them would be married. Says Scott. So, I mean, he's just sort of talking about, you know, how people met. And Kat,
what does he actually mean?
I think what he means is if you'd adhered to the power balance rules,
then they wouldn't have married.
They wouldn't be with their current wife or partner. Kat says, hi, Margaret James. I always thought that if you went to bed with one, then you had to go to bed with all, but then I was a scientist. So I don't know what happens in research facilities, but apparently much wilder than you might have imagined.
Yeah.
This is Panel for the Ages, Margaret Throsby, Lucy Kippist, until the older tier. With us. On Twitter a few days ago, and we did it on the radio as well, I put out a segment which was, and I just wrote this, when you were a child, what rule of etiquette did you find strange? And personally, I found the butter knife confusing. And if you don't understand the butter knife, it's you had to use a separate knife to transfer butter to the plate and then pick up your bread and butter knife and transfer the butter then to the bread. It was exhausting. I was exhausted by the time I got to the bread. And so And I thought this would probably reflect generationally, you know, what was the etiquette of different generations and what would come through. And it was hilarious what we got to. So the kind of things that that people, elbows on the table was a big one. No one could understand why you would be, get your elbows off the table. And people would quote this thing that grandfathers of the 1940s would say, all joints will be carved on this table, meaning if you had your elbow there, you're going to be sliced off. Talking about money, asking people how much they earned or how much anything was. Someone said, if you said, and how much did you pay for the carpets? You know, that was apparently absolutely appalling. Fish knives, soup spoons, the various rules around soup where you have to use the round spoon, tip the bowl away from you, put the furthest side of the spoon into the soup and then, oh, man.
Still do it.
No slurping.
I just pick up the bowl. Come on, Margaret.
Yeah, and, sorry.
But isn't it funny how entrenched these things will be?
Totally. Because you wouldn't do that at Buckingham Palace, would you?
Hats on inside and all the rest of it.
Which is what I was told.
And that was the other thing I was going to try to get.
I sit at the table and say, you wouldn't do that at Buckingham Palace. I'll never be at. Bloody
what was the renovation? What was the reference point? The reference point was often the Queen, or if asked to another family, I'd be appalled if you behaved in anything less than the other.
That's right.
Yeah. So funny.
Table manners were just when I was growing up, and sounds like when in your house too, were just excruciatingly important.
Yeah.
Just excruciating. Yeah. And to this day, if people put their knife and fork down parallel with the, you know, on one side of the plate, the fork and one, instead of putting the fork and crossing it over the knife, I feel like leaning over and saying, you wouldn't do that at my
Talia, what's the piece of etiquette as you're growing up? What were your parents trying to instill in you that you go, I just don't know what you're talking about?
The thing that used to annoy me growing up, like I understand it, but I was kind of on the cusp of mobile phones coming in but still having the family landline. And what was really important that was drilled into us, it was drilled in at school as well, is to how to answer the family phone. And so every time we answered the phone, it had to be, hello, Olatia residence, Talia speaking. And what used to annoy me was that whoever was making the call would just go, oh, yeah, they wouldn't say, oh, yeah, they'd be like, oh, hi, is Marina there? And I was taught to follow up with, may I please ask who's speaking? And they would say, it's John. And so I would go get mum and be like, oh, mum, it's John on the phone. And what used to annoy me about this is that when the caller rang us, there was a 1 in 6 chance that they would get who they wanted to speak to, who would answer the phone. But when we were answering, we didn't know who was out there. And we were always told to answer the phone like that as a way to identify who you are on the phone. And it used to annoy me because I'd be like, well, shouldn't the person be calling us? Shouldn't they be identifying us?
So you say hello and then they say, hello, it's John Smith here and
exactly.
I would like to speak to,
Well, and that never happened. And obviously now with mobile phones is you just ring someone directly and you get them directly. Yeah. So you haven't had to do those introductions. But I remember as a child, like right into my teenage years going, this is the dumbest way to answer a phone.
Well, ours was worse. I was raised to use the number.
Oh, we did too.
923749.
Yes.
And then the person would go, oh, hello, is that the Valentine residence? Yes, the Valentine residence. unbelievable.
Gosh, life in Ballarat, tell you what.
It was like living in Dorset in 1890, really. Lucy, what was the piece of etiquette that was like, oof?
Yeah, I loved this question because lots of things rushed into my head. But actually the main thing that stuck into my head was that we were raised to call any adult Mr. or Mrs. Their surname.
Excuse me, look, I've written Mr.
Oh, you've got
and
the
Mrs.
Same. Yes. Sorry.
So you never knew anybody's first name?
No, and I noticed I have a 7 and a 4-year-old and they just call everyone by their first name. Mm. Like no one even thinks about who Mr. or Mrs. is. And I just wonder how that disappeared because for us it was so important that
that's fascinating because you're a generation behind, or two behind me.
Yeah.
And we all certainly had to say Mr. or Mrs. For the next door neighbour that you saw every day and knew their kids and, you know, were like part of the family.
Yeah. Well, when you were raising, how old are your children?
7 and 4.
7 and 4. So did you think that you'd be introducing your 7-year-old, you know, when they're 4, to somebody as Mr. Smith?
No. And interestingly, what I get now is my sons say, Harry's mum. Excuse me, Harry's mum.
Harry's mum. That's right. Yeah. But you would have always. You
people call you Harry's mum.
Yeah, his yeah, friend. Yeah.
People used to call me Tipper's mum. That was the name of the dog.
Margaret, did you raise your children and you expected that you would, when you introduced them to people, here is Mr.
First
Smith?
Names. No.
You went to first names.
Yeah, we went to, but oh, you know, that was from you being the hippie 70s and things. He dropped all the idea of Mr. and Mrs., but we certainly grew up with the idea.
So your children just go, hey man, what's happening?
Hey dude,
what's going on? Cool. Talia, were you raised to be this is Mr. Smith?
Oh, yes. My parents definitely raised us kids to be. Mm. But what was interesting is it used to be like through primary school, it was very much, you know, if you were hanging out with your friends that after the end that we were taught to go up to them and be like, thank you, Mrs. Smith, for having me this afternoon.
Yes.
And then enough times of someone going, oh, look, just call me Mary or just call me Mary. And then that just became the norm across all kind of areas. I think that that's for me when it personally stopped and referring to my friends' parents as that just on the first go, like they would go, you know, I'm Mary Smith, and I would go, oh, hi, Mary, as opposed to when I was young, I was very much taught to be like, even if they say I'm Mary Smith, I would go, oh, hello, Mrs. Smith. Like, yeah.
Did you fall about and scream like we did if you found out the first name of one of the teachers?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, yes.
Because if you found that out, that was like finding out whether they, I don't know, wore underpants or something. It was so.
It's Brian. The geography teacher's Brian Henderson.
When you got your report cards, that's sometimes when you found it out and you're like, his name is Greg. Yeah. It's just like, that's not as exciting.
Yeah, I know some other people used to refer to people as auntie or uncle, like as opposed if you couldn't do Mr. or Mrs. I think that's when it was a closer
something I was just thinking the other day, just on a slight tangent. That's something I love about Indigenous culture. Mm. People call auntie and uncle, even though there might not be an actual blood relationship.
Yeah.
I love that. I think that's lovely.
And I think in non-Indigenous, I have a feeling, I don't know if there was a rule about this, but it seemed to happen that often the unmarried friends of the mother were auntie. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Our married friends too.
We're married friends?
All the circle of friends of the family were auntie or uncle.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Talia, did you do the auntie-uncle thing?
Yeah, so I'm half Samoan and half Italian, so there was big extended families, and sometimes you kind of lost how that person was related to you. It could have been my mum's auntie or whatnot. So there were times where I was calling people auntie or uncle and then actually realising they were just a family friend, and I had actually thought that, you know, if any day I needed a kidney, I could call on these people as a familial relationship, and it wasn't true.
Yeah.
But it is something that, you know, especially back in the Pacific Islands, that any kind of elder, that you will just be like, oh, yeah, auntie said this and auntie said that. Which I do think that it does have like a kinship and that we are all connected kind of thing.
Yeah. And there's something kind of respectful about it too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, it's nice. I feel like you must have 700 relations, Talia. Yes. Is that a rough estimate? Am I close?
Yes, there are a lot of them out there. But sometimes I go and I'm just like, and how are we related? And it's like, well, it's this person to this person to this person. And I'm just like, okay, cool. That's excellent. Thank you.
And that was a thing of previous generations, Margaret, wasn't it? Yeah, larger families. So you would know people who were eight children whose parents were both came from families of eight, which meant that they had cousins all over the nation.
Yeah. One thing I'm noticing, it suddenly occurs to me, my granddaughter calls me Gran, and some of her friends call me Gran.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm her gran, but they call me gran as well, which is quite sweet, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
I have the same, like, my friends will call my nonna, nonna. Like, when they talk to her, they will also call her nonna. And my nonna loves it because it's just extra mouths for her to feed. And so it's that familiarity. But it is too that sometimes I'm just like, oh, wait, what is my nonna's real name? Like, because just everyone calls her nonna.
Yeah. This is the panel for the ages with broadcaster Margaret Throsby, with Lucy Kippist, editor of Flying Solo, and Talia Olatia, who presents Pacific Beat, which goes out on ABC Radio Australia. We've been having a lovely time with that. It feels a pity to lose that mood, but I've noticed that a lot of people at the end of 2020, as we're getting towards the end of 2020, which also to me seems to have come up oddly quickly. Mm-hmm. It's like the year took forever, but now all of a sudden it seems to be we just did the word of the year on the radio. It's like, what? When did we get to that? Yeah. But I've noticed at the end of it, this sort of sense of ongoing and underlying anxiety that doesn't, I don't know, and I'm wondering whether this has dissipated, gone away, was it there a month ago but now it's got better, and it's because we've lived through such a long anxious period, whether that's because of fires, COVID, US election, whatever else it might be, is this sort of great sense of uncertainty. And I was wondering if you could make a little sort of, you know, think around your circle, around your friends and family. You know, how is it widespread? Do you feel as though that's common? Margaret, what are you observing?
Well, my friendship group is very politically active and interested, and the US elections, I've actually had to stop watching CNN, literally, because I find it keeps me awake. It makes me anxious. I feel really, really anxious about what's happening in the States. I feel anxious about the climate. I feel less anxious about COVID because I think this country has handled it in the most extraordinary way, notwithstanding the breakout in Adelaide and all of that. But I think, and Victoria was just amazing. So I think that Australia is getting quite a different view of COVID from the rest of the world. But that with, you know, the ongoing unease about, will I catch a bus or will I take the car? I'm very conscious of that. But the Trump thing has made me feel very anxious.
I think that's different. Like, you can be connected to the news over the years, and maybe around 9/11 there was a sort of that sort of anxiety.
But not as long lasting.
But it's rare to be anxiously involved in the US election, is it? Rather than just a sort of, you know, intellectually, politically involved. Lucy, how would you measure the temperature?
I really like the word unease. Mm. I think that fits because, yes, we were anxious and we were immediately anxious, but as time goes on and you're constantly anxious and you're forced into that idea, if we just get through to this thing and then the next thing lobs in and then we just get through to this thing and the next thing goes wrong, I think that creates just a more of a sense of like, what's going to happen next, that general uneasiness that life isn't what we thought it was going to be, so what is it?
Yeah, yeah. Talia, how are you feeling?
Yeah, well, I'm in Melbourne, so, you know, when it comes down to lockdowns, I know that anxious, uneasy feeling. And what I think has been really interesting amongst my peers is that whenever anyone announces that, you know, they're expecting and they're having a baby, my first thought now is like, wow, you want to raise a child in this world. And I had never thought that before. I would have, my first instinct, and of course it's, you know, congratulations and all that thing. But now I'm starting to think about that as being like, oh, wow, this is changing not just how I am living, but, you know, how future generations might also live it as well. And I think that the other part of the unease, which is like with our restrictions being lifted, which of course I am all for, is that right now there's this like, it's like I feel like I've lost a sense of spontaneity because, like, now we have to book into pubs. We can only be there for 2 hours. Where, you know, this time last year, if I wanted to catch up with friends, we could just go to a local pub, sit down there and have, you know, a really fun time. So it's this kind of like navigating this new world while also remembering what the old world felt like.
Yeah.
So I think it is that kind of transitional period where we're just kind of adjusting to being like, there was so long that we felt this certain way and we didn't know what was happening, and now that we are going back into the world, but it's not going to be the same world that, you know, it was last year, and what kind of impacts and changes that has, that I'm really seeing lots of people feeling, especially here in Melbourne.
Look, unfortunately we have to wrap it up and get some news, but thank you so much for being on Panel of the Ages. Talia, well done. Thank you. Talia Olotia from Pacific Beat, Lucy Kippist edits Flying Solo. You can look that up online. Margaret Throsby, the eternal broadcaster.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much.
The paddle of the ages, the paddle of the ages, the paddle of the ages, paddle of the ages, the paddle of...
You're listening to James Valentine on ABC Radio.